You've lived through the collapse of vaudeville and burlesque. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast that belches ash clouds of critical opinion across the internet. When Airport became a box office smash in 1969, it kicked off a decade-long boom in films where aging Hollywood stars met their melodramatic deaths in a series of elaborately staged set pieces. For a time, these films were a recipe for blockbuster success, but as the 70s wore on, audiences began to weary of their predictable formula and increasingly daft scenarios. However, it wasn't until one notorious volcano-themed disaster movie that the genre blew up more spectacularly than, well, a volcano. A critical and commercial catastrophe, this film is often described as the movie that killed off the disaster genre. So on this show, we're looking at that fabled work, 1980s, When Time Ran Out. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who enjoys nothing more than watching privileged white people endure horrible on-screen deaths. It's Fred Anderson from Schmollywood Babylon. How you doing, Fred?
Hello. Thank you. What a wonderful introduction. You really pinpointed the what disaster movies are there. You know, fantastic.
Well, it's great to have you back on the show because you've been a guest before, but that was way back on episode 3 when we looked at one of the greatest rip-off films of all time, DNA.
Yes, with Mark Dacascos. Did you know I met Mark Dacascos a couple of years after that? And I brought my DNA DVD and he looked at it and he said, "You're the first one ever who made me sign this." So yeah, good one.
Yeah, what a privilege to be that person. But I really wanted to get you on this particular show because you are a big fan of disaster movies, and you know you've been posting these great little YouTube videos where you look at groups of different films, and you recently recorded a video looking at five of your favorite disaster movies. So I wondered, you know, what appeals to you about this particular genre?
Well, first of all, there is something very, very special with old movie stars getting killed in disturbing ways. You know, I mean, I'm serious here. There's something with that formula that attracts me. Can't really explain exactly why, but you know, it's like Henry Fonda. I love when Henry Fonda shows up in these movies, and he's always the president or the police commissioner. You know, he just stands behind his desk and, you know, probably shot everything in one day. It's like it's anti-exploitation. It's so anti-exploitation that it becomes exploitation. You're using so much, you know, high standard actors and movie stars and let them do this. But there's one more thing, especially with the older disaster movies, which, you know, really turns me on, and that's the miniatures. I love miniature works. I've always done that since I was a kid, and that could have been the main reason why I started to watch these movies as a child. You know, I saw a trailer, or I saw images. We didn't have trailers at the time. We didn't have YouTube, but and I saw these cities in ruins and volcanoes and upside down boats, and I was like, oh, that's lovely. That's the best explanation I can give.
Now, you mentioned something that I thought was quite interesting on your recent video looking at disaster movies. And you were saying that from your perspective, this wasn't a genre that doesn't seem to be sort of very loved. And, you know, I wondered why you thought that was.
I think it's because they're so generic. I mean, look at the first big disaster movie, San Francisco and Deluge, I don't know how to pronounce that. They're so generic you fall asleep while watching them. I mean, seriously. And I think that it's movies you watch one time in cinema. You watch it, you eat your popcorn, you go out and you forget about them. In my experience, everyone is kind of mixing up all these disaster movies. They can't keep them apart. The actors are kind of similar. The plot lines are similar. The disasters are basically the same. It's just on land or on water or in the sky. So, I mean, they offer... it sounds so horrible towards my favorite subject, but they offer nothing new. You know?
But when you've spoken about them before, that you're sort of saying actually that it's the familiarity of the ingredients of these films that are one of the things that really sort of appeals to you. They're almost like comfort food.
Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, they offer nothing new. It's a very comfortable formula. You don't have to focus totally on the story or on the acting. You know that after 45 minutes, the douchebag will get it. You know, or his mistress at the same time. It's like slashers. I think that's why people love slashers so much, because you know what it's like fast food. It's nice, crunchy fast food.
Well, okay. Well, I think it's perhaps time that we got stuck into some of that nice, crunchy fast food. So let's have a listen to the trailer. And it's a very unusual one because the only one I could find is for a video release of this film. And, rather unfortunately, it seems to acknowledge the fact that When Time Ran Out might not be a very good film.
There's not going to be any evacuation.
Another non-believer. Won't they ever learn? Only this guy's problem is a small matter of a very active volcano.
This thing's a powder keg. Well, I think that's a damned irresponsible conclusion on your part.
Oh, well, then perhaps there's still time for a little passion in paradise. That's some kiss. Passion that really sparks. But this sucker makes Mount St. Helens look like a kid's sparkler.
Irresponsible conclusion on your part.
You said that already. Paul Newman, Jacqueline Bisset, William Holden, James Franciscus, Alex Karras, Pat Morita. Excuse me, don't we have any other explosions? Thank you. Burgess Meredith and Hill Street's Veronica Hamill. They were all having a good time when time ran out.
When a volcano on a Pacific island erupts, it looks for all the world as if the glamorous guests of a nearby luxury hotel will be engulfed by molten magma. Fear not, for a hero is on hand, step forward screen icon Paul Newman. With lava racing towards them, it's down to old blue eyes to rally a small group of survivors and lead them on a perilous journey to safety. Naturally, as this is a disaster movie, their escape is complicated by the characters needing to resolve the obligatory array of personal dramas. So, with the island turning into a puddle of liquid rock, the only real questions for the viewer are who will live, who will die, and will the two old codgers harbouring a old grudge finally reconcile in the face of the life-threatening peril? When Time Ran Out came out in 1980, it was produced by Irwin Allen, who was a big name in the disaster movie genre, having produced The Poseidon Adventure, The Towering Inferno, as well as directing The Swarm and Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. There's the sort of all-star cast you'd expect of a disaster film, so you've got Paul Newman, Ernest Borgnine, Red Buttons, William Holden, Jacqueline Bisset, Pat Morita, aka Mr. Miyagi, Burgess Meredith, Barbara Carrera, James Franciscus, and many, many more. It's also fair to say that When Time Ran Out has a pretty terrible reputation. The great film critic Leonard Maltin dubbed it When Ideas Ran Out, while other reviewers pointed out the fact that it had rather poor special effects, the lamentable soap opera subplots, and the rather listless action scenes. The film did very badly at the box office. It didn't get anywhere near making back the money it cost. And Paul Newman later in his life said it was the only film he ever regretted making. So, with all that said, you're probably wondering why we're bothering to review this film. Well, my guest, Fred, has a real soft spot for this film and is a bit of a defender of it. So let's find out what he thinks. So, Fred, what do you think of When Time Ran Out?
I'm not a fan of nostalgia, but this was the first movie I ever bought on VHS tape. Mm. And that probably played in a lot into my fascination for it. I remember the moment I bought it. I remember where I bought it. I remember the cassette. I actually live around 400 meters from the house where this video store was, where I bought it. So I think about this movie basically every day when I, but a friend told me once that when some plants or trees gets old and about to die, they kind of panic produces fruits. And this, it feels like this is what Irving Allen does with this movie. And also The Swarm, you know, he just, you know, the cast is sensational. It's a great cast. It's a really, really competent cast. And, you know, you have a tidal wave, you had earthquake, you have a, you know, volcano eruption, you have a lava flood. You know, he just brings everything into this movie and kind of doesn't deliver on his promises. But, you know, he tries. And I like that. You know, I really... There's so much going on in when time runs out. There's so much beautiful melodrama going on. My favorite is William Holden's old man,
yes,
who courts. I think it's Barbara Carrera who courts her and wants her to be his seventh wife. And why she's even interested in him, I have no idea. So, of course, she chooses Paul Newman. I would have chosen Paul Newman also in this case. But, you know, it's like Charlton Heston and Ava Gardner in Earthquake. You know, it's also like, why? But, you know, you have also James Franciscus as, I think his name is Bob Spangler. That's a great name. who's William Holden's partner in this hotel they're owning. And he's, of course, the token asshole, the douchebag in this movie. He has some little drama there between him and Jacqueline Bisette and another actress who I can't remember the name of now. There is something going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you about the amount of melodrama there is in this film. I mean, as I was watching this, it felt a little bit to me like I was watching a sort of episode of Dallas, because you've got this, you know, glamorous luxury hotel, all these glamorous people floating around. You've got Paul Newman, who is drilling this oil well for, you know, James Franciscus, who basically seems to be the owner of this entire island. He's got, you know, a thumb in, you know, he's got a thumb stuck in every business on the island. And yeah, there's these very complicated, you know, love triangles all over the shop. And yeah, as you mentioned, you know, William Holden is, it's not Barbara Carrera, he proposes to Jacqueline Bisset.
Jacqueline Bisset.
Yes, who's like half his age in this film. And you know, William Holden was 62 when he made this, but he looks about 78. I mean, he was a massive boozer in his life, he sadly died, I think, a few years after making this film. And apparently he was, they had to shut the filming of this film down for 3 or 4 days because William Holden had to go off and dry out somewhere because he was just sort of so soaked up to his eyeballs in vodka. But so you've got, William Holden wants to marry Jacqueline Bisset. As you say, James Franciscus as the douchebag of the film, he's married to William Holden's goddaughter, who is his business partner, but he's having a secret affair with Barbara Carrera, who married to James Franciscus's half brother. So he's not only doing the dirty on his wife, his business partner, he's also doing the dirty on his half brother as well. I mean, it's you have to draw a little diagram to sort of keep up with all of the, you know, relationships and, you know, kind of bunk ups that are going on in this film.
Yeah, it is kind of confusing. You know, I got the names wrong, but, you know, I watched this movie a couple of hours ago, the last time, just to keep me up to date with all the melodrama in it. But you see, you know, it's a lot of tricky love triangles in this one. but I wonder if the most beautiful and touching relationship in the whole movie is between Ernest Borgnine and red buttons.
Yeah.
Yes, which I actually find. I mean, I'm not even ironic here. I think it's a quite touching little story there, and it's also very cliche. Of course, it's a horrible cliche. But also we have Burgess Meredith and his sick wife. I don't remember her name now. Who also have this, you know, they're doing one last trip together. They're some like trapeze artists or yes. something similar, which also, of course, is very important for the exciting finale.
Yes, I mean, that's very when he sort of announces that he's a trapeze artist so early in the film, that it's very clear that that is going to play a significant part in the movie. Yeah. It just is too bizarre a occupation for it not to have some role later on.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
But I think one of the reasons why I still enjoy this film, despite its very obvious problems of, you know, I do think some of the, and we'll talk about them later, I do think some of the action scenes are a bit flat, and some of the special effects are not that great. But I think why I still enjoy it is actually for some of the reasons that you like it, is the fact that you've just got this fabulous cast of so many big stars, and they're in this sort of life and death situation, and you have these sort of dramas of, as you mentioned, Ernest Borgnine and Red Buttons. You know, Borgnine's this cop who's on the trail of Red Buttons because he's a bit of a swindler who's on the run, and because they're in this life and death situation, all of these love triangles, these little grudges that people have, suddenly they become much more heightened. And yeah, just these big stars in this life and death situation, this heightened drama. I still, yeah, even though that this film has some very obvious flaws, I just can't help liking it.
Yeah, it is very easy to love. You know, if you just, I think why many people dislike it is because it was such a flop. You know, people hear about it, they heard it costed $20 million and earned like $3 million, and they kind of expect it to be really, really bad. It's not a masterpiece, I absolutely not. But, you know, it delivers, partly at least, the entertainment you want. And I mean, the cast, you did a very nice comparison with Dallas and similar soap operas, because, yeah, that's what I see also in this. I mean, the location is beautiful. My goal now is to go to that hotel and live there for a week. I mean, it's still there. So it's some kind of luxury resort. Mm. You know, it really doesn't disappoint, except I would say at the special effects department, which is very uneven.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about the action scenes in this film. So there are these big set pieces at various points in the movie. So there's a sort of a scene where we see Paul Newman and James Franciscus, you know, descend into the volcano. This is before it erupts, and there's some suspicions as to how active this volcano is. So there's a scene where they descend into the volcano to investigate, and obviously things go a little bit awry when they do that. There's a sort of a big scene towards the end where the survivors are trying to get across some kind of a river of molten lava on a broken down bridge. In terms of the action scenes in this film, I mean, what did you make of them, Fred?
Some of them I really, really love. I mean, when the volcano first erupts and you have this earthquake going over the island, you see this facility on top of the volcano collapse. I think it's a great miniature work. For example, there's a beautiful shot at an airport where you see the asphalt breaking up in front of the camera, which is very, very well made. But then you have the action sequence, which I think it disappointed me when I was a kid, and that's the tsunami, the wave. Yes. Coming, you know. Yeah, there's a couple of shots where you see the actors or stuntmen getting drowned in water, which looks good, but then you have this awful I don't know what it's not the green screen or some kind of projection effect of the wave coming over the city, which, you know, it's horrible. It's absolutely one of the worst effects I've seen in one of these movies. I mean, this costed $20 million. And
they didn't spend much of it on that scene, that's for sure.
No. And there's so many, and there's so many characters in that scene that you care of. So I'm exaggerating here. You don't care so much about them actually, but you want to know more about them. And their beloved environment is just flushed away in the worst special effect ever. There's also a scene towards the end where the volcano explodes. Which looks horrible. I mean, it's like they slapped it together in half an hour or something. I'm not really sure. But in general, I think it's pretty well made. These are details. My favorite sequence might be when this volcanic rock comes hurling towards the hotel, which is, it's awesome. It's very analog, but it's well made, and it's explosions and there's panic. Love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of myself, I think my favourite action scene from this film is the one, it takes place quite early in the film, where we see Paul Newman, James Franciscus, and this bearded scientist guy descend into the volcano in a contraption that I probably would be reluctant to travel from my first floor flat down to the ground floor in, let alone descend into a volcano, which everyone is worried that it might erupt, which just this just seems like an epically bad idea on all fronts. And obviously the situation takes a turn for the worse when lava sort of bubbles up and smashes the bottom out of the tin can, which they've descended down into the volcano. Naturally, the winch that can pull them out has broken down. And as if things aren't bad enough, the air conditioning inside the tin can isn't working either. And I just loved the ridiculousness of this scene. But it's played completely straight, and it is a very silly scene, but I just couldn't help but love it, especially as the day is saved by Paul Newman's overly muscled right-hand man who basically sort of manually hauls this contraption out of the volcano. I mean, none of it really makes sense, but you know what? I just don't care.
Yeah, I totally agree. I remember that scene also from when I was a kid, and I thought it was so intense when I was like 9, 10 years. I mean, really, really intense. I never really questioned the logic of it, actually, until you talked about it now, because it just hangs in two pretty thin lines, metal. Yeah, also, so it's a highly insecure way to descend into a volcano, and you never should descend into a volcano, I guess, but especially this one.
So, I mean, I did really like that particular scene. I do think some of the scenes are justifiably criticised, and sadly, I think one of the worst scenes in that regard takes place at the end of the film, and I guess it's meant to be the big climax, but it's a bit of a damp squib, where there's this the group of survivors has to cross the lava flow on this broken down bridge, and that sequence, I don't know what you found about it, Fred, but it just went on forever.
Yeah, it's an anti-climax, really. I've never seen such a carefully shot scene where you see one by one very, very slowly climbing over the lava. And then, of course, the ones you think will fall into the lava will fall into the lava. So there's no surprises there, really. And then someone gets stuck and someone has to go out again above the lava. And you're like, no, don't do it, because it's so boring. And it's I'm not really sure what they were thinking there. There's something missing in that scene. Absolutely, I totally agree with you.
Tension, drama, excitement—those all things.
Yeah,
Those are all things missing.
But the lava itself, I think, looks pretty decent.
Yeah.
I think it looks quite okay, actually. It's just everything else. So watch it for the lava.
Well, let's talk about the special effects. And we've already touched on them already. And yeah, for a film that had a pretty big budget for its day, $20 million, it doesn't look like after paying all of the actors that there was really that much left over for the special effects. And, you know, so the volcano in this movie, for instance, it's weird what they don't really seem to know what to do with the volcano, and which is odd in a film that is all about the volcano. So some shots we see are clearly of an actual erupting volcano. So, I mean, they look quite good because it looks like a real volcano, although it's very clear because the stock of the film is different to the rest of the film that it's very clear that you know, they've borrowed that from somewhere else. But then we see these what I think are like miniatures, which are then sort of superimposed into the background of other shots, and some of those look very, very ropey. And I don't know, I just really thought if there was one thing they needed to, I mean, I think they probably could have cheated on some of the other special effects, but they really need to get the volcano to work, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the worst part of the volcano effects is what I believe is matte paintings.
Mm.
And these matte paintings, which is painted volcanoes, you know, put on top of a glass, and you combine it with the real footage, they look so incredibly flat. It's like they've done really, really, really fast, and they haven't, like you said, they haven't really thought about what to do with the volcano. Probably because they had a huge cast of people that were either drunk or depressed to take care of, so they didn't know. I mean, it's like the volcano is the MacGuffin, you know. It's the most important part, but less. It's not important at all. So they just give it a second thought, which is a pity, because I believe that if they had put more work into the volcano effects, the volcano itself, I think it would have raised the overall quality of the movie. It would have been a more even production, at least to look at.
I really agree, because I think, you know, you could forgive them some of the things in this film, like for instance the tidal wave, which, as you say, there's a very horrible special effect involved there, and you know, I think you could have forgiven some of those elements if they'd got the volcano a bit better. But you know, there's some other sort of special effects in here which are quite noticeable. I do agree with you. Like, I love the airport being destroyed, and the kind of the tarmac being rippled up by the earthquake, and the hotel being bombarded by these flaming rocks that have been spat out of the volcano. Although the film ends with the hotel being destroyed, along with you know, James Franciscus and a few others, by this huge, I mean, it's like a meteor that goes streaking across. I quite enjoyed, actually, this huge rock streaking across the sky, and everyone's staring at it as they see their inevitable doom approaching. But then they don't really know what to do once this rock hits the hotel, and it's a really bad sort of special effect that just looks like the celluloid of the film itself is burning up.
Yeah, it actually reminds me of the ending to Meteor, which I think is where the meteor is crashing into New York and Central Park. And there they just cut to tinted footage of buildings being torn down, you know, with explosives, and some fire, you know, close up of fire. I think they have one miniature of World Trade Center there burning or something, but it's also they build up to this mega disaster, and it kind of just fizzles away.
Yeah.
One thing I do love with that ending in When Time Ran Out is because you have this wonderful shot of James Franciscus and one of his women. I'm not sure how many women he have. They're standing there, and he looks stoic.
Yes.
And he sees the rock coming towards him, and she's screaming on the side. and he's waiting to get killed by this. And I love that. It's like the douchebag, you know, he's not gonna, you know, he's giving up, but he's just accepting his fate.
Yeah. He meets a fate that he thoroughly deserves in this film.
Exactly. But I like that shot. I do like that. I could have it on loop here at home, just watching him. No, okay, I'm exaggerating again, but I like it. I do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the actors in this film, because this has a sprawling cast. I mean, there's four Oscar winners in it, and there's countless other Oscar-nominated actors. You know, for myself, I think the person who comes out of this film with the most credit is probably James Franciscus as the kind of the big island magnate, the kind of prime douchebag here. And, you know, he's acting just as you want a kind of villain to do. So, you know, he's cheating all of these women. He's keeping his business partners in the dark about sort of shady stuff that he's involved in. I also enjoyed the fact that in order to make the plot work, he is a hotel magnate. He's also an oil baron. Plus, he's also a scientist who is, you know, can investigate volcanoes. So he manages to wear all of those hats, and he it was only really on this rewatch that I was like, hang on a minute, how many, you know, he's doing all these jobs, and he manages to pull off a very tricky performance, I think, in this film.
Yeah, I mean, his character is obviously a genius, a very douchebag genius, but he's you know, like you said, I never thought about it either until you mentioned it, that he has all these hats on. But, you know, Jan Franciscus, I must say, I think he's a very, very underrated actor. He's kind of always in the background in this late 60s, 70s movies. He comes in, he do his stuff, he dies often. He's like Charlton Heston, but with lesser testosterone. but I like Jan Franciscus more than Charlton Heston.
Yeah.
I think he was a fine actor, and probably, I would say, the only one in the bunch here who just decided to do something with his character.
His character reminded me a bit of the mayor out of the film Jaws, because despite the fact that he knows this volcano is probably going to erupt, he's absolutely adamant that, no, we're going to stay in this hotel. I'm keeping the hotel open. Like, you know.
Yeah,
much like the mayor in Jaws, I'm keeping these beaches open. James Franciscus, he's keeping that hotel open no matter what.
Yeah, and he's also the douchebag, like we said, the token douchebag that makes the decisions and gets punished for it. There's always one of these in movies. I remember there's one guy in Earthquake who maybe he's not so much a douchebag, but he squeezes himself into an elevator and pushes out people, and he goes into the elevator, and the elevator crashes down, for example. And I'm sure you have one in Towering Inferno. Is that, I don't remember who it is.
I think it's Richard Chamberlain. So they're on the,
he's
kicking people off the thing, that's the rig that's going to carry them out of from one skyscraper to the other.
He's the douchebag in that one. Yeah, Richard also a blast always. Fine performance.
On the flip side of that, I think there's quite a few actors in here who disappoint, but I think we do need to take a look at Paul Newman here, who, I mean, he looks very, very bored by this film.
Oh yeah, this is not the high point of his career or his life or anything, I guess. I mean, really, I totally agree. You can look at him and you see that, okay, he'd rather be somewhere else right now. He's just grabbing the paycheck as fast as possible, and he can't wait to take the airplane back to Hollywood or to his ranch or wherever he lived at the time. He's very bored, extremely bored. You have this kind of dead eyes also, like you see when actor really doesn't care at all. They're just kind of empty.
He is completely empty. He's absolutely at zero in this film. But was there any actors that caught your eye, either for good reasons or bad?
A good reason always is Ernest Borgnine, which I think is a wonderful actor. He's you know, he do his shtick, you know, he's doing his Ernest Borgnine stuff. but you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Everyone likes the Ernest Borgnine, I think. I think you probably like him
oh,
too.
Oh yeah, I love him. Yeah, I love him.
And it kind of looks like he and Red Buttons had a good time together doing this movie. So it's nice to see two veteran actors just chilling on some luxury hotel somewhere for a grotesque amount of money, I hope. what another actress, whenever I see her, I feel that there's something special with her. And she plays Mona. She's married to Pat Morita's character. She's this big blonde woman laughing loud. Mm. And, you know, and I did some research now when we were talking, and I realized she was Irvin Allen's wife.
Ah.
So, you know, and she's in several of his movies, probably playing similar characters. But I like her character in this movie. She's a fun character, but she's not given enough. I mean, the writing is so bad and so boring. But you know, you can see both her and Pat Morita is really trying to do something, you know, with nagging and yeah. and their relationship. So I want to give them creds for that.
I mean, I say this with a slight air of reservation because I could be getting something that I actually don't really want. But, you know, when I watch this film, I do think that it could do with being longer because there are so many characters in this film and they all have various plots. But I think some of them get very shortchanged. You know, I think that, you know, we talked about, you know, Ernest Borgnine and Red Buttons. I think we probably needed a little bit more with their characters. I think there's enough here to really understand, you know, the relationships between them, and they have arcs, and, you know, there's a sort of nice moment of reconciliation between them towards the end of this film. But people like Pat Morita's character, the Brian character, who's the half brother, and, you know, Barbara Carrera's character, it sort of feels like we need to be spending a lot more time with these characters in order to sort of really, for the melodrama to really work, because you need to understand the dynamics. And maybe this film should be, you know, 2 hours 40. Now that.
yes,
I might be mad.
Well, here's the thing. I've heard that there is a longer version of it that was released on tape, like in the early 90s or something, by Warner. Some kind of TV cut. As usual, they always do, you know, longer TV cuts. And I also heard it has more melodrama. It has more details on the melodrama. But it never seen the light of day since then, and I haven't seen it myself. I've been... basically, every time I've been watching this movie, I've been tagging Warner Archive on Instagram and telling me, you know, can't you just release this, you know, on Blu-ray, the longer version, or the you know, the movie itself? I would gladly accept the shorter version on Blu-ray also. I once got an answer, and that was no. and I'm going to try again. I'm going to try again because it's time. I think it's there is some issues with Irvin Allen's maybe his business regarding these movies. I mean, he's passed away now, of course, but I'm sure there's some legal problems with it, and that's why they can't release it, because they wouldn't cost them much just to at least release a copy. Anyway. That's a completely different part of the story. It should be longer. I totally agree.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break, not a long one. And when we come back, we're going to be looking at the exploding helicopter action.
He brings the popcorn. She brings the roses. Subject Cinema, a tasty new film topic each week with a side order of film reviews.
Yum.
T.C. Kirkham.
Ba-dum-ching.
Kim Brown.
What?
Over 500,000 listeners, and you could be the next one. SubjectCinema.com. Real movies for real people.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. How does it happen? Well, as magma rolls towards the luxury hotel, the panicked guests look for a quick escape route, and their attention turns to a nearby helicopter. There's a stampede towards it, and people cram themselves inside or cling desperately to the landing skids as it takes off. The overloaded chopper struggles to remain airborne. It weaves around in the sky for a few moments before suddenly plunging straight into a cliff and exploding. Fred, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
I think it's a beauty. It's not everything is a beauty in this movie. I'm really sorry for saying this word so much, but I think that the actual explosion is kind of, you know, it's okay. It is what leads up to the explosion that I find awesome. You have panic at the hotel. Someone is. I think it's Paul Newman who gets hit over the cheek and falls down. And these guys in Hawaii shirts jump up on the... You know, you never get an explanation. Oh, can they really fly a helicopter? Are they pilots? That confuses me every time. But everyone rushes into the helicopter, flies away, and there's people hanging on the helicopter on the outside. Mm. And they're falling off. Maybe drowning, we never get to know what's happening there, and then it just crashes into the side of the island. And that explosion is okay. I think it's a good, nice, big, fluffy fireball. But it, you know, it's the story before that kind of makes it a good one, in my opinion.
I would absolutely agree. I love you just see you know, people in their, I guess, their truest nature coming out in that moment as they all just charge towards this helicopter, and they're you know, they're hitting and kicking each other to get a place inside or to be able to sort of cling on. And we see it sort of spinning around, sort of not, you know, whoever is flying it is not fully in control, out over the ocean for a little bit. And we see a couple of I'm guessing stuntmen you know, drop off the outside of the helicopter into the ocean. And one of them, it's quite a long way down, and he doesn't seem to go into the water you know, like a Olympic diver. I was a little bit worried for his safety. I was thinking, that is really, you're hitting the water like that from that height, that's gonna really hurt.
But yeah, it's an insane stunt. It's a really cool stunt when he falls there.
And there, as you say, it's really the story before it explodes. You know, the helicopter, when it goes into the cliff, it switches out, I think, for a model that is then smashes into the cliff and exploding. But it's actually very well done. It matches the real helicopter, I thought, pretty well. Assuming I've dissected that special effect correctly. The explosion is pretty brief, but it's good enough. And as you say, I think it's really the story before it that makes it such a enjoyable sequence in this film.
Absolutely. And I can confirm that the miniature helicopter used is an exact copy of the real full size helicopter. I actually watched it frame by frame here today, that shot, just because I was also wondering, have they bothered to make the helicopter look exactly the same? And it is. And it's a super well-made shot. And what also struck me with the impact and the miniature helicopter is that it's very, very similar to the helicopter scenes in The Swarm from 2 years earlier. It kind of looks like the same environment or miniature landscape, and the style miniature helicopter crashing into the ground is also very similar. So I was like, first I thought, maybe he used, you know, stock footage from The Swarm. But I think the helicopters in that one looks different than the one in when time ran out, though.
Those are army helicopters in The Swarm. So, yeah, they're very different. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
OK, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Fred, thanks so much for coming back on. Would you like to take a moment to tell listeners where they can find you online?
Yes, I think the best place to find me is on Schmollywood Babylon on Instagram, where I post a lot about movies, genre movies. I'm also on Twitter, Homo Satanis, And if you're adventurous, you can. There's links both on Twitter and on Instagram, but I have a YouTube channel where I'm frantically doing videos about different kinds of subjects regarding mostly movies and sometimes books and other things. But you'll find that on my social media. I would say that's it, you know. And I follow back. I'm one of those. I'm a good person, a decent person. I follow back.
And I can testify to that. Word, so, as always, we'd love it if you head over to our website, explodinghelicopter.com, where we've got lots of reviews and information about films where helicopters explode. Thank you so much for listening. We know you don't have to, but if you do eventually work out how to unsubscribe, we won't hold it against you if you stop. We'll be back soon, but until then, keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.